Australia's Conservative coalition has been voted out of office after nearly a decade in power. Will a Labor government put climate change at the forefront? And how will it tackle China's growing influence in the Pacific? This is Inside Story. Hello, welcome to the programme. I'm Hashim Ahlbarra. Australia has seen unprecedented bushfires and flooding in recent years. The extreme weather has brought climate change to the top of the voters' agenda, and Greens and climate-focused independents made big gains in Saturday's election at the expense of the Conservative coalition. Australia is a major exporter of fossil fuels, and the outgoing government often objected to plans to reduce greenhouse emissions. Neighbouring Pacific Islands say Australia is blocking action, even as their territories are under threat of sinking. Uneasy ties with the island nations are spilling into security, as concerns mount in Australia and the US about China's recent deal with the Solomon Islands. We'll bring in our guests shortly. First, this report from Sarah Clark in Sydney.
Day one in the nation's top job, and Anthony Albanese has promised unity and optimism to Australian voters. He'll hit the ground running, boarding a flight to Tokyo on Monday for his first official meeting as the nation's leader.
Obviously, the Quad Leaders meeting is an absolute priority for Australia, and it enables us to send a message to the world that there is a change of government. There will be some changes in policy, particularly with regard to climate change and our engagement with the world on those issues.
This election race was run on personality over policy. Powerful swings left the Conservative Coalition Party without the numbers to hold on to government as voters drove the Liberals out of key marginal seats. The outgoing Prime Minister returned to his church, conceding his party misjudged the electorate.
You've given us a great foundation from which we could walk what has been a very difficult walk, I've got to tell you, over the last almost 4 years. But at the last election, we really understood that it was for such a time as this. And now we both know it was for such a time as that.
New to Parliament are at least 9 high-profile female independents. The group campaigned for more action on climate change and legislating a federal integrity commission to investigate political corruption. That appealed to voters who abandoned candidates from Scott Morrison's party in blue ribbon seats.
Lovely to see the independents, I think. Real change and a step forward for the environment.
I feel like maybe now's the time for us to do something different. And if we can get action on climate change, then that's going to be quite exciting.
This election has seen a seismic shift in Australia's political landscape. Not only is there a new group of independents demanding greater action on climate change, the Greens Party is also hailing it as their best result ever, with dramatic gains in both the lower and the upper house. The postal vote is still being counted and some seats remain undecided. But the Labor Party has vowed to get down to business with a more united approach to federal politics. Sarah Clark, Al Jazeera, Sydney.
Let's bring in our guests. They're all joining us from Australia. In Canberra, Carlisle Thayer is Emeritus Professor at the University of New South Wales and Director of Thayer Consultancy. In Melbourne, Anna Skarbek, CEO of Climate Works Centre. In Wollongong, Gregory Milovich, Professor of History and Politics at the University of Wollongong. Welcome to the programme. Carlisle, oftentimes climate change is an issue that would be relegated to the back burner of any election campaign, except for this time it has become decisive. Why?
Well, as your lead-in said, Australia has experienced bushfires. Australia is part of the globe, and we have a very active community here that understands the need to confront climate change. I myself participated in 2007 in a study by the U.S. government on 36 countries of interest, and in my particular area, Southeast Asia, sea level rise, which will affect the Pacific and Southeast Asia, was seen. Temperature will change, affecting crops. It will affect infestation by insects. So all across the board, it's a pressing existential issue. And we've watched the major powers equivocate as they attend international conferences, and particularly the Morrison government. And so the reaction by getting the Greens in Queensland, getting these independents, had been to pick up the mantle and say the major powers have failed us, and the major powers, both the opposition and the government, mm-hmm. have lost a substantial from their support.
Anna, what does the shift in climate policy mean for the Labour Party and the new Prime Minister? Are we likely to see less investments in fossil fuels, or cutting emissions becoming a top priority?
Well, yes, the incoming government does have a higher ambition for its climate policy than the previous government. Both parties are committed to the net zero goal for 2050, and the incoming government has a higher target for 2030. But interestingly, that target is not as high as the large business groups, such as the Business Council for Australia and other groups, have asked government to go. And it's certainly not as high as what would align Australia with the Paris Agreement goals of well below 2 degrees and 1.5 degrees. And so the Greens and the independent candidates will ask the incoming government to raise its ambition for the emissions reductions to be achieved in the next decade. Mm-hmm. There are also substantial commitments for investments in transmission and electricity infrastructure and other policies to increase action from industry and electric vehicles. And so there is an increased policy agenda from the incoming government.
Greg, saying that the country is going to take a new direction is one thing, but do you expect any sort of backlash from the businesses which are historically centred around the very basic fossil fuel?
One would expect there will be, at the current point of time, Australian coal exports are doing extremely well, of course, because of the situation in Ukraine and Russia. There's a great demand all over the world for coal in various places, and this is because there's a shortage of both gas and coal. So in some ways, the current economic circumstance in Australia is very much being held up by both coal and gas and exports of iron ore.
Okay. Carlisle, for the time being, we have to wait and see whether the Labour will have a majority in the parliament. But in case we end up having a hung parliament, how do you see policies being shaped? Do you think he will have to reach out to other parties to be able to deliver on his promises?
Well, the Labour government has said, and we'll have to see if they can maintain it, that they're not going to enter into deals with parties. Now, they're sitting on, at the moment, 71 projection to have a majority. But if they haven't, depending on the size, they need 76 seats. Mm-hmm. They're independent, and they're talking about David Pocock from here in Canberra, or negotiating with the Greens, which would then create difficulties for the government, particularly if they demanded a seat in cabinet.
Anna, quite fascinating the way Climate 200 and the very few donors have stepped in, providing massive support for the independents, are changing the political landscape in Australia. Are we moving towards a direction now where climate change is going to be the top priority for the political establishment?
Well, I think what it shows is that the community had moved ahead of perhaps where the mainstream politics was, and the mainstream politics has been the subject of quite divisive debate over the last decade in Australia. And the Teals and the independents, the Voices Of movement, have been funded by some large donors, but also thousands of small donors. But also business has moved ahead. And Australia is an economy that certainly exports significant fossil fuels at the moment, but also is an open economy with a very large financial investment international outlook. And so we are very plugged into the trends of the shareholders in the institutional investment community internationally. Mm-hmm. And so those investors are expecting rapid decarbonisation for the safety of their investment portfolios over the long term. And so that has begun to significantly shift Australian business and industry and the financial sector, who have begun to make their own net zero commitments and begin to make preparations. And so there are many in the community, as has been shown by the Teal independents and the increase in the Greens vote, that are expecting Australian business and government to do more. Uh-huh. And I think the vote today has reflected that the community and industry had moved forward during the decade that the political debate was quite stuck, and this is perhaps a catching up recognition of that becoming more visible.
Greg, many takeaways from the outcome of the elections. One of them is particularly the fact that the Conservative coalition has suffered major setback in urban areas. Are we likely to see both of them reinventing themselves or changing the way the balance of power has always been maintained between these two key players?
I think that what's happened, we have to understand that the Teal candidates all got up in very wealthy and affluent areas. And in Sydney, Melbourne, and and Brisbane, it was the inner city areas that voted for either the Greens or for the Teals, and that in other parts of Australia, for example, the National Party, which represents large parts of the rural establishment, didn't lose a seat. In outer suburban areas, the Liberal Party did not lose many seats. So, you know, what I suspect will happen is that there will be a political realignment, particularly with regard to the Liberal Party, because it'll have to decide whether it's worthwhile going back and trying to win back these seats, or whether it will reinvent itself as a party that perhaps is more focused on rural and regional and outer suburban Australia.
Carlisle, one of the most spectacular takeaways from these elections is the rise of the Teals, the independents. Is it an indication of people frustrated over the legacy of the Conservatives, or a sense that Australia now is determined about the need to move forward towards new directions?
Well, I think it's a bit of both. I mean, one, the frustration with the existing parties, but I see it as a reaction to globalization and moves in other democracies, a kind of flare up like we've seen in the United States. And not that these are exact, or in Hungary, in parts of the United Kingdom, where the old established parties are now being challenged, and movements have international connections. They can raise issues, particularly on climate change, and have a great deal of authority in challenging the political parties. And then you just add to this, rising inflation, skyrocketing prices for your petrol, and you have dissatisfaction. And you mentioned the corruption, the mistreatment of women under the Morrison government in Parliament. Undermining the norms that they have. And even now, today, within the Liberal Party, were they too conservative or too progressive is a kind of argument. And so this is playing out, and I say it's a reaction both to the existing system, but I think in reflecting international trends in democracies.
Anna, for climate advocates in Australia, this could be a unique moment because you have the Labours gaining ground, you have the Greens, and you have the Teal independence also making gain. Could be the moment for all of them to team up to be able to come up with a stronger policy as far as implementing climate policies are concerned?
Yes, all the ingredients are in place for that. Indeed, over a decade ago, when Australia last had a minority government, there were pro-climate independents with the balance of power, and very significant improvements in climate policy and action were taken then, some of which were repealed, but many of which are remaining today. Institutions such as the Green Investment Bank, the Clean Energy Finance Corporation and ARENA were set up in that parliament and are operating successfully and have been supported by governments of both parties since. And so I think it is indeed an important moment, but also it's arriving at a time when the climate change opportunities and threats are far more visible to Australians. So you've already mentioned the fires and the floods that have made climate change far more physically visible from the risk perspective. But also the opportunity has become far more visible. The cost of renewable energy and batteries has continued to fall dramatically. And the availability of these technologies has become better understood. And indeed, the shift has begun in many state governments and in the energy system and the sector. But also the manufacturers who are currently part of the fossil fuel economy are recognising that Australia is blessed with natural advantages to export zero emissions energy and commodities using the resources that we have to create green hydrogen or low emissions metals and minerals. And so many companies are beginning to invest substantially in preparing for the next chapter of Australia's economic growth, which would be to serve a global zero emissions economy. And so indeed, the incoming Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, said in his acceptance speech last night, "Together we can take advantage of the opportunity for Australia to be a renewable energy superpower." And so this understanding has become much more widespread in the last decade, and all of those forces are coming together at this time.
Greg, the Liberals lost because there's this prevailing sentiment across the country that they were somehow laggard when it comes to tackling climate change issues and in denial.
I would disagree with that view. The Liberals lost for a whole range of reasons. The reasons in Western Australia, I think, were quite different to the rest of the country. They didn't do well in urban areas. There were things to do with cost of living. There were things to do with petrol prices. I don't think that you can put a single cause on the elections across a country. For example, there was a swing towards the Liberals in Tasmania. So these things are far more complex than to say, oh, it was just because of climate change.
So in this particular case, they lost in urban areas, they maintained their strongholds in rural areas. Are we likely to see them reinventing themselves in the future in a way where they will have to redefine their core constituency and agenda to be able to maintain the support and the constituencies they still have?
Well, I think the Liberal Party's had been divided between two sections, the moderates and the conservatives. The loss to the Teals has actually decimated many of the moderate faction element of the party. So it's got to decide, is it going to try and chase those seats or is it going to try and do something else?
OK. Carlisle, there's another legacy that the Labour Party will inherit, which is the strained relations with China. Their win in this election, what does it mean for the future relationship with China?
The Labour Party has said it's when they take office, it's up to China, which has frozen ministerial contacts for several years now, to rescind that policy and open up the possibilities of dialogue. The Labour Party doesn't have the baggage of the extreme rhetoric that we've heard during this election campaign. And so the personalities do matter. Chinese ambassador here in Canberra has held out possibilities of a kind of olive branch, which is different from his predecessor, a wolf warrior. So the very fact that there's a new government opens a possibility that there could be room for compromise, but Labour is being very careful because, as your introduction, our Prime Minister now is just, our Prime Minister-to-be on Monday, just flown off to the Quad meeting. Mm-hmm. And the Quad being in the Quad has this informal understanding of trying to contain or counter Chinese influence. So they're not going to look well on an Australia that's going to give away the farm if it's going to open relations with China, which it isn't. But the government will come under pressure for business to solve trade problems. But still, it's China that puts the tariffs on and doesn't hold ministerial contacts. So there's an opportunity for China because the parties are different. Mm-hmm. And we have to see. So I think it's with the Morrison government, they boxed themselves in a corner in a sense, not necessarily of their own making, and relations wouldn't have improved. And really, the ball's in China's court. Can it see an opportunity with a new government?
Anna, whichever path this new government is going to take, it will have to look into its relationship with China and the impact of that relationship on future deals, particularly when it comes to climate change. Do you think that this is the government is going to be extremely delicate, careful in whichever direction it's going to take as far as the relationship with China is concerned?
I think we've seen in the past that in relation to the global agreements on climate change, they have indeed sat above somewhat the geopolitics. We certainly saw that with the US and China in the lead up to the previous major climate meeting. Where it becomes quite relevant for Australia is in our immediate Southeast Asia region and the Pacific. And certainly Australia's relations with its Pacific neighbours have been tested due to Australia's stance on climate change action in the past and the vulnerability of our neighbours in the Pacific Islands to extreme climate damage and their desire for wealthy nations such as Australia to reduce emissions much more rapidly to help secure the safety of nations in the Pacific Islands in our region. So there are many nations in Australia's region that are interested in Australia's progress on climate.
Greg, from 2018, when the Australian government banned Huawei from the from its 5G network all the way towards the pact between the Chinese government and the Solomon Islands about setting up what the Australians fear could be a military base that could change geopolitics of the region. Are we likely to see this new government in Australia take a robust approach, particularly as the Americans and the Japanese remain pretty much concerned about China's growing influence in the region?
And I think you should include India in that as well. Mm-hmm. That's why it's the Quad. Now, Australia is, I think it was compared, to a flea on an elephant in comparison to our relationship with China. We sell a lot of things to China and we perhaps were trapped into selling too much. We import a lot of stuff from China. There's a definite, very strong connection economically. From a point of view of necessity, we have to have at least a workable relationship with China. I think at the present time, it is very difficult working with China, simply because it's been flexing its muscles over the last 10 years or so. I'm just skeptical, actually, whether any government in Australia actually has the sophistication to really deal with the Chinese government. I'm yet to be convinced that either side of politics is actually has that capability.
Especially the trade volume between the two nations, especially as far as the Australian exports are concerned, which were standing up at about something like $104 billion over the last few years. This is going to be really taken into consideration for whatever decision the Australians will have to take for the time being. Carlisle, Thayer, Anna Skarbek and Greg Milovich, I really appreciate your insight. Thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you too for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. For further discussion, go to our Facebook page, that's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. From me, Hashim Al-Barra, and the entire team here in Doha. Bye for now.